Hey everyone, it's another OneLiner.com podcast. I, as always, am Craig, and with me, as always, Scott Morris.
Delighted to meet you.
And Andrew Tavendale.
How do?
We've been out of the game for a little while, so we do apologise for that. We obviously try and keep to our schedule, and it was working reasonably well, but Wolves did it. So, without further ado, we're going to crack on with a bumper, crazy, exciting podcast of stuff. Yay!
Yay.
A somewhat star-studded cast fatten out the premise of Now You See Me, a thriller centred around magicians who conduct bank robberies during their shows, sharing their ill-gotten gains amongst their audiences. Sounds like a silly premise, but the movie has outperformed all expectations, so perhaps there's something magical about it after all, Scott?
No.
Oh well.
I was suckered into this because I do have a soft spot for magic tricks and things like Darren Brown, that kind of thing. But I really enjoy all that sort of stuff. The trick is not to look for the trick, because then you're wasting your time. The whole point is to be tricked. Now, the problem with Now You See Me is it's tricked you by having a really likeable cast that is full of people who I would normally pay good money to see in pretty much anything. You've got Mark Ruffalo as the FBI agent who's eventually called in to sort of track down all this wrongdoing. And the magicians themselves. Woody Harrelson's normally a likeable character, especially in kind of jokey throwaway roles. Jesse Eisenberg, one of my favourite actors of late. And even though the smaller roles are filled out by guys like Morgan Freeman, who, well, okay, can be great,
can be in every film at once.
can be something mercenary, but Michael Caine's normally good value for money, and people like Isla Fisher and so on. You know, this had a good cast. The trailer does a great job of focusing on these, and rather than the people who are, you know, behind the camera, because that's Louis Leterrier. And also, if you look at the writer's credits, Ed Solomon's also responsible for Super Mario Brothers, so that should give you some indication of what you're letting yourself in for. The basic plot is such: these four magicians of varying quality, Jesse Eisenberg's Daniel Atlas, Woody Harrelson's Merritt McKinney, Isla Fisher's Henley Reeves, and Dave Franco's Jack Wilder find themselves invited to a mysterious apartment in New York, I think it was. They wander in and uncover mysteries. Some of them have passed together. Some, Jesse Eisenberg's the young rising star. Isla Fisher used to be his assistant, but now she's trying to break off on her own. Woody Harrelson's a con man slash confidence artist who also kind of dabbles in hypnotism. And Dave Franco's a sort of up-and-coming young street magician kind of person who also doubles as a pickpocket. And so these people with their unique talents are brought together and receive instructions into how to pull off some of the greatest tricks, illusions, and what turns out to be heists that the world has ever seen. And Mark Ruffalo, as I said, playing the FBI agent out to stop him. Its problem is that it's just all very, very stupid. As I say, with magic, you're always kind of looking for the trick anyway. That's kind of part of the deal with it. But the problem with this was none of it's even remotely convincing. None of the characters have any kind of real character or showmanship to them. And so you can't really take them seriously as magicians. And the magic tricks that they perform themselves are quite bad, because it's a lot of it's just quite obvious CG rather than sort of clever sleight of hand. I mean, I'm sure at some point they've not even built a stage properly. I mean, you could at least have built a stage and have an audience around it. That's not difficult. Don't try and do it with shit CG, which is what the route went to here, and it kind of doesn't work on that basis.
If they want to kind of do subsidiary stuff like, oh, right, we'll put an audience in by CG, that's fine, but surely the point of a film which is about magic is that to use CG for the magic then completely defeats the purpose of doing a film about magic.
Yeah.
Wasn't that a bit of a problem too with that Steve Carell, Steve Buscemi film you saw, Craig, recently?
It was. From what I understand, some of that was actually practical and it was actual sort of like magic routine. But yeah, some of it they had to resort to CG for. And at the point you realise they're doing that, it's like, okay, yeah, you've just completely shot yourself in the foot now.
You've undermined everything, haven't you?
Yeah, exactly.
So with this film, while I would probably let all that slide if the story and the central arc through it had been either interesting or particularly believable in some way, but it just isn't. It gets increasingly silly as it goes throughout the film, and by the end of it, you really are just in no mood to pay any attention to anything that's going on. So when they do have the final reveal of who's the puppet master behind all of this, you are not going to be even slightly surprised, because there's no one else who it could be at this point. And so when it's sitting there self-congratulating itself, going, oh, bet you never saw that coming, eh? Ooh. It's like, yes, I did about an hour ago. And it's very difficult to have any kind of love for it left after this. There's an interesting idea of a film in here struggling to get out. The concept of using magic as a front to perform grand heists and bamboozling the Keystone cops who are chasing after him isn't actually, I can concede that's not a bad idea. I can see there's ways that could have worked, but this is not it. Very disappointing, stupid story, a lot of characters who are just completely, firstly underserved by the material they've been given, and secondly don't perform to anything like the standards that most of them are capable of. No one's particularly likeable, there's not an awful lot of charisma on display, it's all just a bit boring, it's just very bland and not really worth your time. It's not doing anything completely terribly, but at the same time it never gets above mediocre in anything that it tries, so yeah, you can give this one a pass.
Pass. Ben Wheatley has become something of a cause célèbre for British independent cinema since Kill List put him firmly on the radar of cult aficionados. Following up with the quirky and dark murder spree comedy Sightseers, we probably felt we were getting a handle on Wheatley's signature style. However, A Field in England, released simultaneously across all formats, cinema and on demand, has thrown something of a curveball. Is that a curveball which has become a home run, Drew?
Well, I think the fact that it was released across all formats, including television, on the day of its release is the most interesting thing about it, which may tell you quite a lot. The Field in England is Ben Wheatley's fourth feature, and it's his most distinctive and in some ways, I say, ambitious film to date. It's set in an anonymous field after an English Civil War battle, and the story follows Rhys Shearsmith Whitehead, a cleric and scholar, after he runs away from his master during the battle. He meets up with three soldiers, and they traipse across possibly the least interesting stretch of land in England, until they meet Michael Smiles O'Neill, an Irish alchemist who is searching for a mystical MacGuffin-y treasure. It's full of trippy imagery and drug references, particularly magic mushrooms, and what A Field in England screams particularly throughout is festival film. While I screen myself, why am I watching this? But watch it, I did. There's little point in trying to convey the plot here, as it doesn't have one. You know, and that's not something that's a problem. In fact, I'm entirely fine with it. A plot isn't a necessity, at least so long as there are interesting characters. But there are no interesting characters here. Indeed, there aren't really even any characters at all. There are five men with only the barest of traits to define them, and they spend what feels like a great deal longer than 90 minutes doing nothing interesting at all. One theory of this film holds that these five people are actually facets of one man's psyche. Even if this were true, they don't together add up to even one interesting person.
So it's not five times as good as Fight Club then?
In the end, it can be, entirely fairly I feel, summed up as some people doing weird shit in a field one afternoon. Some people doing weird shit in a field one afternoon that you shouldn't and can't care about, all shot in ugly black and white. As far as I'm concerned, it's a disaster. I can't find a single thing of merit to this film, and the only thing of interest I found at all was that for a £300,000 budget film, in which absolutely nothing happens at all, there's a credit for a third assistant director, which left me scratching my head.
But tell us how you really feel.
I'm just assuming that the third assistant director was charged with getting that critical shot of a tree in some grass, because there's nothing else going on.
Sorry, £300,000?
Yes.
For this?
Yes.
How?
Could it have been filmed on a cell phone at probably 1/300,000th the cost?
Yes.
This looks like it's been filmed on a kind of mid-range DSLR. It doesn't necessarily look bad, but there's not much artistry there. All you're really doing is having a few guys in a field. Unless those period costumes cost a hell of a lot more than they look like they cost, I really can't see where all the monies went. That's very puzzling to me. Funny you mentioned this being about shit in the field. About 20 minutes of the film does actually concern someone trying to take a shit in the field.
Yep.
There just really isn't anything of remote interest in this film. None of the characters are particularly interesting. I don't know what any of them are supposed to be doing.
They're not characters, Scott. It's not even like they're one-note things, that each one has a character trait, in which case you might buy the aspects of the psyche thing. But they're just sort of people with some clothes on. They're just forms in a field doing nothing.
By the end of the film, it's just broken completely with reality and makes no sense, and not no sense in the fact that I'm not interested enough to actually engage with it on a point where it makes sense. It just doesn't have a point. It just stumbles along, then ends. It's out seems to be, ooh, magic mushrooms. It was all psychedelia. And it's just not even remotely interesting. And I can't believe I wasted 90 minutes watching it. It starts off incredibly slowly and only gets slower from there.
As I said, it felt like far longer than 90 minutes. It's just not a good film in any way, shape or form.
Very disappointing. Dreadful pacing, poor characters, hard to say much about the script. It doesn't really seem like much happens, so it's kind of hard to dismiss the script. But it feels very forced. None of the actors seem to be particularly comfortable with the oldie-worldy dialogue they've been given. It doesn't feel even remotely naturalistic, and that seems to be the vibe they're going for. It's a kind of fly-in-the-wall documentary of nothing happening in a field in England. Didn't work for me. Don't really see any value in it at all. No. Nope. Nope.
Yes?
Nope.
Oh, yes.
As an introduction to the wonderful world of Ben Wheatley, it's not a positive one, so...
Damn. Sofia Coppola's latest directorial effort takes a true story as its inspiration, namely that of a group of teenagers who robbed Hollywood celebrities' homes by monitoring their movements on social networking websites. Most would agree Coppola has since failed to repeat the near perfection attained by Lost in Translation, so does The Bling Ring see her back on top form, Scott?
You're funny. I like you. No, there really isn't a great deal to The Bling Ring other than what you've said in your introductory couple of sentences, so perhaps shan't labour the point, but the central core of it is that you have a self-doubting young teen, Mark, played by Israel Broussard, and he is kind of struggling to fit into a new school, but he befriends Rebecca, played by Katie Chang, and while they're sort of getting to know each other, he's busy searching the gossip websites, works out that you can tell when some of the famous people that live around him are actually going to be away, so they decide, why not just drive up to these now empty houses, break in, have a bit of a look around. Something to do, isn't it? After they do that a few times, they wind up bragging about it to other people, and before, sooner or later, they've got a little gaggle of mainly girls who are happy, you know, breaking into Paris Hilton's house, having a look around, drinking the booze, and, you know, lifting a few trinkets now and again to pay for their increasingly lavish lifestyle of getting drunk and doing drugs and so on and so forth. That is basically it. There is almost no attempt at really getting to know what makes any of these characters tick, apart from perhaps the initial 20 minutes or so where you're trying to come to terms with Mark's struggles to fit in. He's gay and sort of struggles to fit into this new place, which you wouldn't think would be much of a problem in Hollywood, but apparently there still seems to be. He struggles for acceptance, but he starts getting it by sort of boasting about how they're breaking into these houses. But other than that, all it's really doing is showing them getting drunk and taking drugs and breaking into houses, and none of that endears me to them in much of a way. It doesn't last forever, of course. Eventually they get busted because they're making no attempt to conceal anything about what they're doing. They're not hiding masks, they don't care about CCTV or anything like that. I'm surprised they lasted for so long, and if this is indeed based on reality, then I have to question what the hell police are doing, because anyone with a vague degree of competence should have caught these people after their first attempt. But the fallout of their arrest sort of breaks up the gang a little bit, and you have a little bit more characters as people try to deal with the fallout and shift blame onto other people and leave the state and run something like that. But so the last quarter of an hour gives you something more interesting to get your teeth into, but you've kind of lost interest by that point, if I'm being honest. It does, for roughly an hour, just show you people breaking into houses and getting drunk and trying on clothes and looking at handbags and looking around houses. And it's not very exciting in the slightest. Yep, Sofia Coppola seems to have just got lucky once. It's horrible to say that, but she's just not... Maybe I'm being unfair. She's not actually doing anything particularly wrong with the production of this film. I just don't think she's got the eye to pick source material anymore.
Mm.
This just is not remotely interesting enough to be made into a feature film, and I don't know why she's fallen so hard onto basically a short Vanity Fair article and tried to turn it into a feature-length film. It shows a lot of the sort of Coppola style. She does have a great sense of visual style, and lots of the scenes do look particularly wonderful. I mean, she's good at showing, you know, lavishness. That's kind of pretty much her bag, and she nails it quite frequently. It's possibly the only thing that's of slight interest during the middle third of the film, but as a story, there's just really nothing here. You have to wonder if she really needs a better talent scout or agent, I think, to whittle down her choices a bit more. She shouldn't be given so much free reign if this is the sort of thing she wants to do. Just find whoever gave her Austin Translation and sort of stick with them.
Hmm.
Not recommended. It's not doing anything dreadful, but you just can't care about any of the characters or any of the things they do. So, yes, not a particularly interesting film either.
Boo. From one based on a true story joint to another, Dwayne Johnson heads up Snitch, the story of a father who turns undercover operative for the DEA in order to attain freedom for his imprisoned son. Given Hollywood's penchant for turning true stories into improbable exercises in stunt and FX work strung together by equally improbable narrative, are we finally dealing with a serious drama contender, Drew? Are we?
What do you think?
I think not.
You'd more or less be right.
Oh!
Although that's not to say it's bad. Let me explain. I'll just expound a little bit on what you said there, Craig, about the setup for it. John Matthews' son, Jason, is set up by an acquaintance who he thinks is a friend but isn't, to receive drugs, upon receipt of which parcel, a huge posse of DEA officers appear in the scene, guns in hand, because apparently one 17-year-old boy is really, really hard to bring to justice. After that, he faces a prison sentence for drug dealing unless he gives up his connections, this largely being how the authorities work in these cases. There's a mandatory sentence, but it can be reduced if you snitch on other people. Except Jason is just guilty of not much more than basic teenage idiocy and doesn't know any drug dealers, and he's looking at a decade or more in prison.
Bummer.
Seems fair, doesn't it?
Yes. First offence for a non-violent crime, decade in prison. Well done there, America.
Bet he's wishing all he'd done was rape someone.
That's the problem, isn't it? Yes, but let me go on to that. So John decides he must help his son and agrees with the federal prosecutor to go undercover as a drug smuggler himself in order to reduce his son's sentence. I mean, this is the really believable part of the film, of course. And this move puts him on the radar of a Mexican drug cartel. Not somebody you want to know of your existence, really. Perhaps the most interesting thing about Snitch is the fact it stars The Rock, also known as Dwayne Johnson, in one of his rare forays into more serious roles. It recalls 2004's Walking Tall, though this is considerably more low-key and involves fewer scenes of beating people up. But it's quite pleasant, really, though. Too many actors are content to stay in a comfort zone, and it's really rather pleasing to see Johnson push himself and take on this sort of role. And also that a producer was willing to do the same and take the risk on him. Johnson acquits himself well here. I mean, he's not going to win any acting awards, but he's watchable throughout, and I would say he's very much believable as a concerned father. And while they're due to the actor, the director, or audience expectations, though, there is a seemingly obligatory action sequence, which, while not empirically bad, is by far the least interesting portion of the film. In the end, the film is less than stellar, but it's interesting enough, and The Rock is given decent support from Barry Pepper, John Bernthal, and Boardwalk Empire's Michael K. Williams. And I think the important thing is, if you're a fan of The Rock, then I think you'd get some pleasure out of watching it. But if you can take or leave The Rock, you'd probably want to find something else to spend your time on. One final word, though. The biggest emotional aspect of the film is likely to be anger. Not so much, indeed at all, from the film itself, but from the real mandatory sentence laws the film features. Be prepared to shout and swear some more, and possibly swear again, and definitely shout some more.
This is why I don't take you to the cinema anymore.
This is why I don't commit crimes in America.
Yeah, it's pretty baffling, isn't it? It seems to be a set of laws that is basically entrapment. You're throwing someone in jail for a decade based on, at best, a non-committal Skype conversation and signing for a package. The film itself, I possibly enjoyed a little bit more. It's certainly a little bit above average. It's not absolutely stellar, but I did like it to a reasonable extent.
Yeah, I mean, it's an okay little film. Yeah. It's not going to live long in the memory, but
no,
it's okay. It's a decent enough little thriller. I've certainly seen far worse films of late, and within this podcast too.
The two films that feel closest to me was, well, firstly, for obvious reasons, Walking Tall. It's something of an attempt to, you know, be a bit more serious. And also Hummingbird, which we
spoke about last one.
For similar reasons, both, you know, there's probably a sensible plot in here, which is at points hampered by having The Rock in it. Not so much because he can't perform what's asked him in the script, but because they've quite clearly changed bits of the script to shoehorn in an action sequence. Particularly towards the end, which is perhaps the worst part of the film, where he's, you know, running gun battles with a heavy goods vehicle.
That's the bit I was referring to. As I say, it's not empirically bad, it's not a terrible sequence in itself, it just doesn't belong there, and it doesn't fit in with the tone of the rest of the film.
No, it doesn't fit in with the character, which he's done quite a good job of establishing. I mean, it goes out pains, and it does quite well point out that you're not actually watching The Rock, but The Rock, you know, his first instinct is to go to the street corner and find some drug hustlers and beat them up. And that doesn't work very well. He gets his ass handed to him because, turns out, he's not The Rock. Turns out he's just the guy that runs a medium-sized haulage firm.
Yeah.
So it kind of throws all that away towards the end, and he just kind of forgets what it's trying to do in the first place, which is a little bit upsetting.
Yeah, and it'd be much more effective if he was fearing for his life, not because somebody's running alongside his HGV trying to shoot him, but because he knows that a Mexican drug cartel are after him or going to kill him, and that he can't do anything about it. He's powerless, which would have been a much more compelling portion of the film.
to be honest, that's really Motley Niggle Brother. The rest of it, I kind of like. I like The Rock quite a lot. I think he's got a good sense of charisma. It kind of works pretty well. For the most part, the story's interesting. It drives along at a fair old clip. It works pretty well. The story is quite interesting, the way he kind of gets slightly screwed over by the Drug Enforcement Agency and kind of goes a bit deeper than he was supposed to and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. All that kind of does a good job drawing you into the narrative, and it does a good job of characterization with that. Yeah, for the most part, it works. I liked it quite well enough.
I've got a lot of time for Dwayne Johnson, I have to say. I think he's an eminent, he's very much like Jason Statham. He's like an eminently likable presence, and more so than, obviously, Jason Statham would be a good analogue for him on this side of the pond. But I mean, who's the other actor that might have filled out this kind of role over there, like Vin Diesel or someone like that? I find Dwayne Johnson infinitely more charismatic than the likes of him. And like, all right, again, like Walking Tall, the film we mentioned before, not like a masterwork by any means, but what was enjoyable, anything that was enjoyable in that film was generally to do with Dwayne Johnson. And yeah, I'm looking through the list of films we're going to talk about tonight, because I've only seen one of them given my schedule at the minute, and I'm thinking, yeah, there's two or three films on here I'd like to catch up with, to be honest. And I think it probably says something about him that of the ones we're talking about tonight, Snitch is one of the ones actually I'll probably add to my on-demand watch list, because I'd quite like to see what he does with it, because I think he can fulfill a broader spectrum than guys of his physique and reputation are normally given.
He's certainly prepared to in other films to sort of poke fun at himself too, the sort of the macho aspect of his persona, particularly in Be Cool, in which he was largely the only good thing in it.
Yeah, he seemed, do you know what, he seems like a good guy. He's charismatic, like you say. He doesn't mind a joke at his own expense, and he's actually not a terrible actor. So
no.
Very much like we said with Statham and Hummingbird, yeah, like, more of this, please. So at some point, someone's going to give, this guy's going to get a role in a film that actually, it's not going to win him an Oscar, but people are going to go, shit, wasn't he actually really good in that?
Yeah. Mm.
There you go. Richard Linklater returns to the story of Jesse and Celine in the third of his Before series, Before Midnight. Each film following 9 years after the last, the story has followed the arcs of two chance lovers whose lives seem destined to lead them down different paths. The series' previous two entries met with almost universal praise, powered in no small way by the chemistry of leads Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy. The question on everyone's lips is, can Before Midnight land a hat-trick for its director? Well, can it, Scott? Can it?
I don't know. Part of my problem with watching this film is I've not seen Before Sunset or After Sunset. So I am honestly not the person
it
best
almost,
place to give you an
answer. It almost seems remiss to throw to you on this one then.
Yes, but well, I have at least seen it. So I mean,
what possessed you to jump into the third part of a trilogy, you fool?
As with all things in relationships, there's give and take. If you're going to go and watch nonsense like, well, films we'll talk about later, you sometimes have to go to films that you might not otherwise have chosen. Not necessarily because I thought it would be a bad film, but because, like you say, it's the third film in a trilogy and I've no real business complaining about not really understanding what's going on in it. Now, I would have struggled with this film anyway, because I kind of blow hot and cold on Richard Linklater. I think probably due to an early experience where I was exposed to Dazed and Confused, which I found insufferable, and I've not really bothered to watch anything of his that he worked on since between then and about 2006, I think, when Scanner Darkly came out.
Mm-hmm. Which was triumphant.
Yes, and to a lesser extent, maybe School of Rock. I have...
I forget is even one of his.
Yeah, I take it not particularly characteristic of his work, but still enjoyable, and it kind of put a reassessment of his career on my list at some point, but it's quite low down on the list, if I'm being honest with you. So I should point out that this film, Before Midnight, has been getting near universal acclaim, and I'm assuming that is not the work of mass bravery or hysteria, but on the basis of two films worth of stored empathy and liking for the characters and the situations that feature here, and I don't have that. So that is going to colour my opinion of the film, and it doesn't give it a pleasant colour. At any rate, you join Jesse, played by Ethan Hawke, seeing off his son, Hank, at the airport, sending him back to his mother after a summer holiday in Greece with Jesse and his wife Celine, played by Julie Delpy. Apparently they got together somewhere between here and After Sunset and are now kind of living their life together, on the way back to enjoy the final day of the holiday with their two daughters at the writer's retreat staying at. They start gently picking up the threads of clearly long-standing issues that escalate over the course of the film. And that, in a reductive nutshell, is pretty much all you get from Before Midnight, which rather leaves out the positives of the film, but none of those lie in the realms of narrative. There's no character piece more character piecey than this, or I assume the other films in the series, and for their flaws, or perhaps because of them, Celine and Jesse seem like very real, grounded, believable, middle-class nightmares of characters. Verite, mission accomplished. The dialogue, which as I understand it is half improvised compromise between Delphi and Hawk is similarly sensible, and while Celine appears to be picking up old wounds just for the camera, as there's next to nothing here that shouldn't have been settled years ago, I can forgive, or at least ascribe that to a convenient break from reality for the purpose of filmmaking.
You wait 9 years to tell me this?
What I'm less inclined to forgive is that this film is basically 2 hours of incessant nagging and bickering. Realistic nagging and bickering, to be sure, but that hardly makes it any more interesting to listen to. It feels kind of like you're sat in a restaurant next to an annoyingly loud couple having a breakup. At least there you'd have something more appealing to eat than popcorn and cinema nachos. I have my opinions on Before Midnight, and certainly if it's not been made clear by the tone of the before rants, my opinion of Before Midnight is that it's mainly irritating. Well made, certainly, and convincingly acted for sure, but mainly irritating. However, like the Big Lebowski's Donnie, I have no frame of reference. I am like a child who has wandered into the middle of this movie and wants to know why I should care about these people, and I'm not given any reason to do so. But should I expect that? I mean, I wouldn't have any sympathy for someone going into The Matrix Revolutions without seeing the first two films and not having a clue about what's going on.
Although you might just in general have sympathy for people going into The Matrix Revolutions.
Bad example, but you know what I mean. What I'm getting at
is... It'd be like wandering into Transformers 3. You would have no idea which robot hated which other robot.
The metal one hates the other metal one.
You just wouldn't do it.
Maybe I am selling this film short because I don't have the same investment in the characters a lot of people do, but even then, I can't help but shake the feeling that this is being reviewed without reviewing the sunk cost fallacy in mind. Even if the first two films established these characters as the greatest, bestest characters ever, which I assume would be some combination of Indiana Jones and Richard Downey Jr.'s character in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang with the voice of Bane in The Dark Knight Rises, there's still the matter that in this film, they're whiny, grating annoyances. There appear to be a school of thought this provides a nice bookend to the series, tying together the cliffhangers and loose end to the last film. My advice would be that you can happily infer those from the trailer and ignore the film, as looking at it without any time invested in the characters, it's pretty clear that this is 2 hours of middle-class, middle-aged bickering that adds nothing to understanding of long-term romance or of the characters.
Leave it out, my son.
Bloody hell. Sorry I asked. When giant monsters emerge from a deep-sea portal between worlds and begin laying waste to humanity, there is clearly only one option, nuclear weapons. However, let's imagine that for some reason those aren't an option. Failing that, the simplest course of action would probably be to build equally massive nuclear-powered robots that can be piloted by two humans, somewhat improbably linked by a convenient technology that allows them to sync their minds through shared memory. Right? That would be the best thing to do.
It's obvious.
Right?
It would, yeah. In a world that sometimes has countries that take 2 years to repair a road.
Let me tell you, boys, Guillermo
Del Toro.
It's pronounced Giles.
Giles Del Toro clearly thinks so, and having passed on The Hobbit, he instead brings us Pacific Rim, a film in which giant robots beat the shit out of giant monsters, and vice versa. A pleasant change from robots beating up other robots, certainly, but is it any more than that? Well, boys, listeners, I am here to tell you that no. Disappointingly, no, it is not.
I didn't see you going there at all, Craig.
Well, I'm somewhat baffled by Pacific Rim. Not only disappointed by it, but baffled. Now, I've made no notes on this. This is going to be a free-form jazz rant. Since this film was announced, I have been super excited about it because at heart, like most men, I am still a 12-year-old boy. When the first trailer came out, the 12-year-old boy in me immediately wet himself and said, this is going to be the best thing ever. Guillermo del Toro is an infinitely more capable director than Michael Bay, the only other person to recently have tackled the giant CG robot genre. And Guillermo del Toro works from a set of references, both cultural and artistic, which I think have a great deal more merit to them than Michael Bay does. And if anyone was going to do justice to the giant robot genre, it was going to be Guillermo del Toro, a man who has directed both some of my favourite films of all time, such as Pan's Labyrinth, which is slightly more arthouse and slightly more deep and meaningful than other output he's managed, such as Blade 2, which managed to be like a fantastically entertaining big-budget blockbuster. The Hellboy films, another point in case, fantastically entertaining big-budget blockbusters, which don't pander to the lowest common denominator. How then, when Pacific Rim was considered to be something of a passion project for them, it has turned out to be quite so bad, I don't know. I have a number of issues with this film. Let me explain first of all that where I'm coming from, I have this very definite cut-off point. There are two very definite plateaus to my opinion of this kind of thing. One of them is incredibly high, and then there's a very steep drop down to incredibly low. And where that drop happens is, up to a certain point, I will tolerate a sort of a serviceable script. It would be nice if it's serviceable with a bit of humour in it, and there are one or two nice performances and the action is good enough to pick up the rest of it, then the 12-year-old in me is happy. Just because the 12-year-old in me is happy with the notion of giant robots beating seven shades of shit out of giant monsters doesn't mean to say that the 34-year-old man in me will be happy with the most risible script associated with a summer blockbuster in quite some time. I am not joking when I say that the script for A Good Day to Die Hard is better than the script for Pacific Rim, and that is a pretty low benchmark to begin with. What plot there is, these giant monsters, kaiju, pop out of an interdimensional portal in the sea and start devastating cities. For some reason, we need to build giant robots because nuclear weapons aren't good enough, despite the fact that later on in the film, demonstrably, sub-kiloton yield nuclear weapons prove even underwater to be fantastically good at dealing with even the most powerful of these kaiju. However, that wouldn't allow us to have massive robots punching them in the face with afterburner-powered fists. So, okay, let's see past that. What do we need in that case? Okay, Christopher Nolan demonstrated a couple of years ago that you can have a high-concept summer blockbuster which has essentially quite a silly or at least fantastical plotline, but which can also service the intellect somewhat. Pacific Rim, being directed by Guillermo del Toro, following that benchmark, is something that I would have expected to have demonstrated or at least tipped its hat towards my intellect somewhat more than it does. There is literally nothing to this movie other than giant robots punching giant monsters in the face. It is pathetically written to the point where I was literally cringing. I'm sitting in the cinema with my wife, literally cringing at some of the dialogue. The casting is bizarre. Even Idris Elba, fairly reliable. He was one of the better things in Prometheus, I like to think. He's generally regarded as being one of the finest actors currently produced by Britain, sort of working today. That's great. I've liked him in any number of things. He was fantastic in The Wire.
A safe pair of hands, you would think.
A safe pair of hands, you would think. Even he cannot manage to chew his way through the script. I mean, alarm bells are ringing when you see that sort of, and it's become a bit of a meme now, the whole sort of cancelling the apocalypse line that was in the trailer. Okay, that's the best of it. Inexplicably, Australia has run out of TV actors because we have two Australian characters being played by British TV actors, one of whom is from EastEnders, both of whom are choking horribly on an accent that there was no real need for them to have to tackle in the first place.
I think a second you, though, you were going to say Australia's run out of tea, and I was saying that film took a turn I did not expect.
Yes, for all I know, Australia has run out of tea, because if it's run out of the kind of actors who could have done infinitely better justice to these roles than the people our nation's managed to provide, then who knows what's happening over there, right? I can't get my head around how it could be quite so shoddy. I mean, I don't know, I can't tell you off the top of my head what else Travis Beecham has written. I'm going to click on his name here on IMDb.
Clash of the Titans.
Oh my god, suddenly everything is becoming clear. All right. Regardless of that quality of script, I'm thinking to myself, well, no, not regardless of that quality of the script, the actors actually, I'm not surprised they can't deal with it. But to have actors of the calibre of Idris Elba, and you know what? Charlie Hunnam's not terrible as well. If you've watched Sons of Anarchy at all, you know, he's a competent actor. He's not going to set the world alight. His relationship with Rinko Kikuchi in the film, who becomes his co-pilot, threatens to, on paper at least, sort of sizzle and bring some real life to the story. But it is loaded with such clunky lines as the pair of them sitting there on a gantry looking at the robot that they pilot. At this point where their relationship is crossing the line between professional and romantic, and part of the robot's chest piece has been removed, and Charlie Hunnam says, "Wow, it's incredible. I've never really seen her heart before." Right, that's a nuclear reactor you're talking about. There's only so romantic that's going to be. That's the level the script is at, okay? The other massive, massive problem I have with the film is that the set pieces, I'd like to say it flies along and the action set pieces carry it. They don't. It's how long?
12 hours.
2 hours, 10 minutes. It felt almost like 2.5 hours. Shouldn't be the case. The other thing that has completely wound me up about it, and I will not accept this argument, is that a massive number of people online, this film has an average 7.6 rating on IMDb, more so than most ratings on IMDb. I am here to tell you that that is utter bullshit. A lot of fanboys are jumping this film purely because it's a giant robot film. They're making this argument that it's meant to be bad. It's a homage to sort of badly translated anime and Japanese mecha films. Right.
That's grasping at straws, isn't it?
No, yeah, exactly. That's really grasping at straws. No, it's just an incredibly badly written film. Let me tell you something about the Hollywood studio system. Hollywood doesn't throw $180 million at a homage to anything, regardless of how much money they might think it's going to make. Hollywood did not give Guillermo del Toro $180 million to make a homage to a niche genre. that appeals to about 20 people on the planet, right? They gave him $180 million to make a blockbuster film that should deliver the kind of entertainment and, at the very least, a script. I don't imagine that on an intellectual level, okay, I think I'm asking a bit much for this to challenge me intellectually, like Inception did. However, for this not to have a sort of zingy, funny script that at the very least prove entertaining is absolutely unthinkable. And anyone who wants to make that argument is a massive, massive idiot. And I will not tolerate their point of view on anything else. It's purely badly written. I'm familiar with Evangelion, I'm familiar with Macross, I'm familiar with a lot of the Japanese anime from which this draws some inspiration.
As opposed to the French anime.
Do you know what? Those weren't badly written in a way that this film pays homage to. Those were actually pretty well written. It's just that by the time they reached these shores, they were part of that first wave of anime that frankly was subbed and dubbed by people with only a mild grasp on the Japanese language.
Yeah, often without actually having the full script. And being told to take like two completely separate series and try and condense them into one somehow.
Yes, so that's why those ended up being so cringeworthy in terms of the dialogue and the plotting. Often the dialogue and plot weren't the dialogue and plot in the first place. That is not what the studio gave Guillermo del Toro. I'll say it again: $180 million to do. That's all I've got to say about this. I was massively, massively disappointed by Pacific Rim. I'm not going to tolerate any arguments in its favour. Guillermo del Toro should be put in the corner for this. He is infinitely more capable of doing better than this. Travis Beecham, why would you spend $180 million on something coming from a script by the guy that wrote... Sorry, what was it again?
Clash of the Titans.
Brilliant, brilliant. I literally can't get my head around it. At the time, I was kind of... Even at the time, I wrote my review for the website, which is far more literate than I've managed to present my argument tonight. At the point I wrote that review, I think I was still felt like making excuses for it, and I think I gave it an arbitrary 3 out of 5. Well, actually, I'm saying now it's probably a 2 out of 5. So, the more I thought about it...
I think you're being somewhat generous to it there.
Well, the more I've thought about it, the more angry I've got. But you give me your... Because I know you saw it, Scott.
What I find interesting is this may be the most boring film that Ringo Kuichi's been in, and she's been in Norwegian Wood, a film where literally nothing happens. Mm. And this film has giant robots punching Godzilla in the face. Yeah, I was very ready to check my brain at the door and go, whoa, it's got robots, it's got Mazinger Z punching them.
It hardly had to do anything to get us to love it, right?
It seemed like an obvious slam dunk. And for about the first 20 minutes, I was managing to sort of batter down that voice because like some of the dialogue's really clunky, but I thought, This might turn out to be so bad it's good. Not even that. I think, that's a bit dodgy, but I mean, it's starting off with some a relatively decent action at the start when your fella's brother gets killed in that fight. And I thought, this is reasonably impressive. This is more or less what I signed up for. I'm okay with this. But then it just gets increasingly dumber as it goes on. And it's just so many really clunky choices, so many bad choices, and I'm not sure, I think I mentioned this before, I don't fully subscribe to the sort of sci-fi thing if you get one big ask, and this one big ask is we need to build giant robots to fight these giant monsters. I'm like, okay, fine. But it just keeps adding layers of stupid on top of it until it's got this impenetrable wall of stupid.
The big ask was the monsters. Yeah, I'm willing to buy that because that's the point of the film.
But
don't ask me to believe we wouldn't just nuke them.
And everything that goes on after that is like, we need to create some drama by mothballing this program that's apparently been successful enough in favour of building a big wall that obviously won't work. And lo and behold, it doesn't work, thus forcing us to our backs against the wall situation for no good reason whatsoever. And it just keeps going on with these kind of just bizarre choices. All the actors are doing their... Well, I suppose they're doing their best, but they've got nothing to work with. It goes to great lengths building up characters that are then immediately killed, amongst many small things that annoyed me. And it kind of becomes cumulative to the point where you just give up on it. But there's points where it talks about how great these Russian pilots are. They're fantastic.
They're the best things in about five minutes.
They're almost unbeatable. There's nothing you can do to stop them. And these Chinese guys, they're super impressive. They have the Thundercloud formation. What the fuck's that? Don't know. I never get to see it. Because both those teams get killed in the first time you see them in action. So what was the fucking point of having them in there? Secondly, one of these fucking monsters works out that as part of their evolution or whatever it is, we'll have a massive electromagnetic pulse that will shut down all the systems and these machines and everything else. But it won't affect the one that our heroes are driving, because all these other ones were digital, this one's analog. It clearly fucking isn't. It obviously isn't.
It's a big computer-controlled robot.
There's nothing less analog in the world. Oh, it's nuclear, it's analog. What?
Even also, they're confusing analog with mechanical.
I don't understand what they're getting at. It's like,
it's not powered by a computer, it's a Turing engine.
There will be people that says, you shouldn't take this seriously. It's not supposed to be like that. Treat me with a slight bit of intelligence, please. Just the slightest bit. I would have let it slide if you'd said, just not been so, if you'd not gone out of your way to be so fucking dumb.
Do you know one of the things that annoyed me most, though? The two fucking comedy characters, the comedy relief characters, the two
scientists.
Geeky scientists. Because do you know what? The comedy sidekick character is something that's proven so valuable and so popular in blockbuster films throughout the years that there was really no good reason not to use it here.
But every film's got to have somebody you despise, right?
Yeah. Oh my god. Well, take your pick in this one.
You can psychically link into another dimension from a dead brain of some other thing. What? What? You're just making all of this up, but none of it makes any sense. And you're not being entertaining. Your dialogue's amazingly clunky. There's nothing that seems even remotely close to being realistic in any of this.
Isn't there some conversation at some point, lip service is paid, correct me if I'm wrong, because they're probably dozing off. At some point, someone mentions nuclear weapons and why they're not effective. Am I right there?
Probably.
It's something like, oh, because, you know, you can't just nuke a city. It's like, yeah, but they then go out to point out they've got like a good hour's warning or something when these things emerge from the portal before they reach land. So I'm guessing that's enough time to safely nuke them. Because later on in the film, it's not giving too much away. These kaiju for some reason we have some arbitrary scale for how powerful these kaiju are. Oh, these kaiju are a 3 on the scale. We have no idea how big they might get, but for some reason we already know our scale ends at 5. And eventually, of course, oh, how convenient, a level 5, 2, 3 level 5 kaiju have appeared. So the most powerful of these monsters you can possibly conceive, 3 of them turn up at a time, and they're dealt with by one underwater nuclear explosion, basically. Right, okay. Sorry, someone explain to me again why we can't just use nuclear weapons to begin with. Your robot program is redundant, isn't it? It's like you say, okay, I'm willing to buy into a certain amount of stuff. Come up with some arbitrary reason, a better reason. Have the portal on land. Have them, or near land, so that you can't just drop a nuke on them. Don't have it an hour out to sea and then tell me that you can't use nukes.
It just simply, don't give me time to think about it. Just keep going from action to action, rather than having a bit of action at the start and then stopping for an hour with some of the worst script I've ever seen, some of the worst dialogue I've ever heard, and some of the most boring characters I've ever come across.
I know we're splitting hairs here, and I'm telling the windmills, but that, like, and at the start, that scene at the start where he and his brother, and it involves them rescuing like a fishing trawler. Mm. It's like, okay, we've established that we have a time scale. We know roughly when these kaiju are going to appear, how many of them are going to appear, and what strength they're going to be. There's only one portal. It stays in the same place. Don't let people fucking fish there.
Yeah.
Oh no, there's a trawler out there. We're going to have to go out of our way to save it.
No, you don't. Let them. It's natural selection. Let them get killed. They were probably Spanish. Goodness gracious. I feel like we spent far more time talking about that than it deserved, but I can't emphasise how much of a disappointment, how much of a missed opportunity it was.
I wanted to love it so much.
It really didn't have to do much.
I felt betrayed by it. Before you even went into the door, I'd already given you my heart, and then you just shat on it. Mm. And I don't like having my heart shat on.
I take solace that from what I gather, you feel exactly the same way I do about it, Scott, because I know so many people have said, like, oh yeah, I really liked it. And I've read so many people online going, yeah, it's great, isn't it? I'm thinking, am I taking fucking crazy pills here?
I'll bet you it's the same people that walked out of King Kong going, oh, I loved that, I thought it was great, I had a big monkey, and then no one's ever even thought about King Kong in the past, like, what, 5, 6 years, whatever it is.
But then you only have to look at the budget, the box office receipt of the Transformers films to realise that apparently for a huge percentage of the populace, big robots is enough. Right, yeah, it's just that this was our opportunity to actually recalibrate that and have people realise how bad the Transformers films are by going, yeah, here's big robots in a film, this is actually quite good.
Yeah.
And if anyone was going to do it was Guillermo del Toro, and I feel distraught about it. But like,
as it turns out, the Transformers films are better, and God knows what's bad enough.
Actually, do you know what? As much as I hate the Transformers, well, the first one, because I refused to watch it, as much as I hated that, and like I wailed on you guys for giving it some sort of appreciation, I have to admit, and I feel like choking here, that probably Transformers, the first one, is probably like a 3 out of 10. And Pacific Rim is a 2 out of 10. So it's probably splitting hairs a bit at that level. But I would have to admit that Transformers was probably a better film than this. I don't know how that's happened. I don't know how that's happened. I take solace in the fact that you feel as bad about it as I do, Scott, because I was fully prepared for you to pass your judgment on and go, it wasn't perfect, but I quite enjoyed it, and I would have probably thrown myself off a tall building.
So what we're saying then is that until we finally get to see the X-Men Sentinels on screen, that if you want to see a film with a big robot, you should probably just stick with the gore in The Day They Have Stood Still.
The original, yes. Well,
obviously, not the Keanu Reeves version.
Yeah, I wouldn't advocate the Keanu Reeves version.
Oh. Or the Iron Giant.
So,
the Iron Giant.
So what we're saying is basically one animated film from the 90s, is it? And a 1950s film is the pinnacle of big robots on screen.
So far, yes.
Well, wait a minute. Let me check what year, because I have a better example of you, of a giant monster fighting a giant robot, and it's 1975's Terror of Mechagodzilla. In which at least the evil robot Godzilla has the good grace to let its head rotate through 360 degrees and shoot lasers, if I remember correctly. So that's instantly more entertaining than Pacific Rim. Do you know what? Actually, the best thing that I've heard anyone say about the only good grace I've heard anyone grant Pacific Rim was my wife said, I quite enjoyed the score.
Mm.
Well done. Well done, Pacific Rim. Alrighty then, well, that pretty much wraps that up for this podcast. We will be back probably sooner than you expect. Tee hee hee. However, for now, I was Craig, Scott was Scott.
Goodbye.
And Drew was Drew.
Was that a normal outro? I don't know how to respond to that.
Just throw you every now and again.
Goodbye.
Try saying goodbye, yeah, there we go. I feel like people listening have probably had short thrift, because I don't think we've actually enjoyed any of these that much. Apart from maybe Snitch was okay. Yeah, anyway, we'll speak to you soon.
Bye.
And that's pretty awesome, because I like bats, and I haven't seen them out here before.
There's a bad man.